wish in the well. Don't ask me, I'll never tell. I looked to you as it fell, and now you're in my way. I trade my soul for a wish, pennies and dimes for a kiss. I wasn't looking for this, but now you're in my way. Your stare was holding, ripped jeans, skin was showing. Hot night wind was blowing. Where you think it's you're going, baby? Oh,
where
hey,
we go?
I just met you, and this is crazy. But here's my number, so call me maybe. It's hard to look back at you, baby. But here's my number, so call me maybe. Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy. But here's my number, so call me maybe. And all the other boys try to chase me. But here's my number, so call me maybe.
Podcasting from Studio 2520, somewhere near Akron, Ohio, and via the paid subscription of Zencaster, the campus of Otterbein University. This is Tackling the Chicane. So our intro track this evening, Carly Rae Jepsen, Canadian singer and songwriter, placed third in the fifth season of Canadian Idol.
That's not that great.
It is a great song. Soaring strings, lots of synthesizer.
Interestingly, Carly Rae Jepsen, which you wouldn't really expect from this song maybe, but sort of a critical darling of sorts. Her 2015 album, I believe it was called Emotions or something like that. Critics ate that up. So
influenced by 80s style, apparently, vis-a-vis Wikipedia.
I would just like to quickly dial it back to your first factoid. Third place in the fifth season of Canadian Idol. If I have that correct. Third place in Canadian Idol.
Correct.
What probably
it comes down to is just a nice jouncy track with some soaring strings and something that you can't feel sad listening to.
That is true. Infectious pop tune.
That's correct.
So. All right. Well, kicking off the show in a jovial fashion. 70th episode of the program, Tackling the Chicane, now into its 70th podcast all time. And it's shaping up to be a nice one once again. Actually, a little bit of news to get into. In the F1 paddock, before we transition into another classic race rewind, this time from the 2012 Formula One World Championship. And let's not forget on the soccer side of things, the Premier League season marches on. Arsenal making themselves known that they are still well and truly in the title fight with a thrashing of crosstown rivals Crystal Palace, which we will sink our teeth into on the bottom half of the show. But for now, let's quickly dive into the AlphaTauri rebrand here, because it's pretty straightforward, but wondering what your thoughts are on it. So if you're not in the know, AlphaTauri, the junior team, basically, of Red Bull, rebranded for the 2024 campaign into what is it, RB. So they're going to be called the Visa Cash App RB Formula One team, full name, but RB basically.
Yeah, so here's what's very disappointing about this series in this modern day and age is everyone's always had sponsors. Sponsorship is key. 50, 60 years ago, sponsorship key. But let's not put just a stupid moniker on a team. I don't give two shits about the Visa Cash App. Can we give it some spice, something? Can we call it something besides RB? Visa Cash App Formula One team. That's the most shill. It's the most shill. I mean, put a beer on the car.
Yeah.
I'd like to see a Guinness livery, for crying out loud. Would be freaking awesome. But the Visa Cash App? How cool is that going to be?
Yeah, that's not great. I just think it sounds dumb. RB, that's RB, seriously. So when
obviously they put Red Bull in the coffers. Yeah. RB, they didn't even come up with a full name. And then it must be the Visa Cash App. Cash App.
Cash
it's just
app.
So lame.
It's like the stake, whatever the hell, betting, blah, 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 clusterfuck Sauber F1 team or whatever we got this year.
Yeah, there's a few out there. I just kind of like the more pure sponsorship. You know, throw a name on the car, throw a constructor on the car. That would be the best if they just, you run whatever team constructor you're running. So it should be Mercedes-Benz or BMW or you know, so on. I was as undelighted as you were when that name was released. I mean, AlphaTauri was bad enough because I just recently found out. I always knew it was a fashion brand, but I didn't understand that it was a Red Bull fashion brand of clothing. So just more lameness.
I mean, does Red Bull need to have a fashion brand?
Well, gotta make some jack somewhere, I guess.
I guess. I mean, whatever. So there you go. RB, that's going to be the name of the team for this season. So just a quick tangent. I didn't even realize, I never even thought about this, but the Sauber team, their color scheme is like green and black. So it's going to look pretty different this year from what I've seen so far.
Well, and that's a good move on their part.
Yeah. So I'm actually pretty interested to see when that livery gets dropped, which I think they're releasing February 5th. But should be interesting to see what's going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as we close out January, we'll be soon, you know, starting the next season of F1, and the Netflix series is going to drop, I think, the 23rd of February.
Yeah, that sounds right. Season 6. Oh, boy. Right.
So what I traditionally like to do is go back one season and watch the episodes from season 5 to refresh my memory. And then, you know, sadly, this season 6 will probably still have a lot of Steiner-esque moments.
Yeah, you'll have to savor them.
Right. So
I
don't know how, honestly, I mean, how long can this, that thing sustain itself before people get bored with it?
Yeah, I have to imagine the numbers are not rising in terms of watchers each season nowadays. Maybe when it was in that first three, maybe even four seasons, but
I think we have to remember that, you know, F1 is a rising series amongst the U.S. gambit, I guess. And people love their series that they can watch or sit down and do four or five episodes in a row. So I don't know. It just, I'm curious to see how this thing plays out. This type of stuff, maybe five good seasons, and then it kind of gets a little.
Yeah, I don't. And there's been some people already kind of saying that it's sort of past its prime.
The funny thing is that none of the actual people who are filmed and participate, drivers especially, they're not real big fans.
No,
although
they
should be, because it brought this series to a whole different level.
Yeah. I don't know. I think they are green lit through a seventh season, so we'll see what happens after that. It's a numbers game, really. If F1 and Netflix see it as something to keep doing, they will. So we'll see. One other little tangent here. The trailer dropped yesterday. NASCAR is also getting the Netflix treatment. That's coming out January 30th. I don't remember the title of the show, but basically it kind of looks like Drive to Survive if it was NASCAR.
So yeah.
I'll probably at least watch a couple episodes and see what it's all about. Just, I think that is a thing that can only really help NASCAR, as it only really helped F1. So we'll see.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that. I mean, I would sit down and watch a 5 or 6 episode series.
Yeah.
You know, NASCAR needs a little boost.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and it's amazing what a bingeable series will do for interest in a sport.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And
so I'm fine with that.
Yeah. And Netflix has really gone into the whole like sports docuseries thing since Drive to Survive popped off. Like, they've done golf, tennis, now getting into NASCAR. I just saw a rugby thing coming out. So, I mean, they're really going full guns a-blazing with the docuseries. So, yeah, we'll see. I like I said, I don't think it's ever really a bad thing to have that on your side. But I don't know.
Yeah.
One final little piece of news before we get into what you had prepared with Jensen Button. Charles Leclerc of Ferrari basically announced his contract extension. So he was signed to 2024, and then basically today in classic F1 fashion, the details were scant, but basically he has signed past 2024, so his seat is not in any danger anytime soon. So there you go.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I wouldn't expect anything different necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. I think Leclerc is clearly committed to that Ferrari project, and I don't know. I'm hoping to see a little bit more fight from the prancing horse in 2024, but we'll see.
So shilling this straight from F1's information. So God forbid if F1 ever shut this podcast down for us just taking meat from their stories. But Jenson Button, who was, and we spoke about the Braun 2009 F1 team champion that year, was asked to predict who may be able to unseat Red Bull in 2024. And basically his answer was Mercedes. So
do elaborate. I'd like to hear a little bit of justification, I guess.
Basically he said, you know, last 10 years in the sport, Mercedes has been one of the more strong teams. He would have loved to have said Ferrari, but the closest competitor at the end of the season was Mercedes. Perhaps we may see, you know, a Lance Stroll uprising.
I wouldn't hold my breath for that one, but
if I had to choose, I would say Mercedes has the best chance of unseating if that's going to happen. And then, you know, my next choice would be, McLaren with, you know, the Piastri, rising of just kind of being there at all times.
Yeah. And Lando Norris is, I think he is maybe the second best driver in the series on his best day. That lineup is only going to get better for McLaren. So I can sort of maybe dark horse money you'd put on McLaren maybe finishing in that second spot. But I do definitely agree that if we're looking at it from a sort of objective standpoint, that Mercedes are the team that are most geared towards defeating Red Bull. I mean, let's be real. Budget is huge. They have basically unlimited money. Toto Wolff is maybe the best team principal, maybe no worse than second best team principal in the series. And they have Lewis Hamilton, who obviously his reputation pretty much precedes him. And George Russell, I think George Russell is the wild card because, let's be real, he wasn't all that impressive last season. So I think in order to get to a point where Mercedes is challenging Red Bull, it's going to have to come down to George Russell really carrying his weight.
Yeah, and we're going to see some upgrades from a couple of different teams. Apparently there's going to be a rather interesting upgrade to the Aston Martin car this year coming. So, you know, if I had to choose again, I would say Mercedes will bring a fight as they always have. McLaren will be right there. Ferrari is what Ferrari is. So, you know, I guess if I look to the other end of the spectrum, I'd like to see some more advancement from the Williams team. And I guess we'll see.
Yeah.
With the Haas.
Oh, boy. They might be a train wreck.
They put all their eggs in the basket of their, is it Eyal?
Yeah, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but yeah, something like that.
And then we'll see where Steiner ends up. You know, he's not going away. he may be cast off to another team here, or even if it takes a year, he'll be back.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Right now, it doesn't seem like many of the team principals are necessarily on the hot seat. Of course, that can change throughout a season, but I don't know if he'll leave the sport entirely. Maybe he comes back in a role that isn't necessarily team principal, but we'll have to see. Does seem like he's too strong of a personality to not be in the sport, but I don't know. We'll see.
All right. So let's move back in time a bit here to the 2012 European Grand Prix, which was held in Valencia, Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple notes I have here. In that particular season, they had already had seven separate winners in seven GPs to this point. So
yeah,
that makes me a little bit sad for where we're at right now. To see seven different guys
win
in seven races. And as you know, right now we're in the
I'd be thrilled with three this season. Thrilled. Yeah. Maybe some listeners don't really get, like, to have seven different winners in seven races and in any F1 season ever is a huge, huge deal.
Yeah. And that was probably one of the best competitive seasons of F1 that we've seen, mm-hmm. or that I've looked back and seen, 12 years post. Going into it, constructor standings were Red Bull 1, McLaren Mercedes was number 2, and then Lotus Renault of all things was number 3 in the constructors. So
yeah, so
definitely a totally different landscape.
Mm-hmm. We're gonna get into Lotus here. I think we will. I mean, where is that Renault now, which is Alpine? They were damn competitive in this race. And Mr. Romain Grosjean, now of IndyCar acclaim, was driving like a madman in this one. To see Lotus, basically Renault, be that good was a little jarring for me, and it was also just interesting because it was Grosjean, and I believe, was it Raikkonen or Kimi Raikkonen? Yeah.
The other note that I have pre-race is this may have been, and I could be completely wrong, but DRS may have been in its infancy in this race. It sounded like, based on the call, that this was new technology.
Yeah. I think it was, if not in its first season, maybe second. Yeah, because they were treating it like a novelty, which now, of course, it's standard issue, basically. But you still had the KERS system, which we talked about the last time from that race from 2009. Now, this is their 3-year difference, but it's two separate eras of F1 in terms of the car. So, like, obviously, you know, if you are familiar with the sport, it kind of functions in like the era of the car. So 1 year of difference can be all the difference, you know? So this was different. I don't know if you happen to know the engine that they were running.
I have a note here with a question mark that said engine specs, and I did not do my diligence, but these power units were turning 18,000 RPM, and you could hear it on the rebroadcast of just how howling these things were. I don't believe we're, I think we're in the 12s now, maybe, RPM wise.
Yeah, the
RPM is, that's, you know, my M2 does 6,900 at redline.
Yeah. So the RPMs, I believe, are lower. The horsepower is higher these days. And of course, it's the V6 hybrid. So I just looked up the engine specs. All engines in the 2012 Formula One season were 2.4 liter V8s. So 8-cylinder engine there.
Yeah. And so turning that kind of revolution per minute is pretty incredible, especially from an 8, you know, banger option. And they do, they sound like jets.
They're wild. They're mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is sort of nitpicky to modern day F1 maybe, but if we could get the cars sounding a little bit more mean, that would be nice.
Well, I think with the movement to a green space, we're probably not going to see what we saw back then as far as, you know, just angry.
We're not going to get
ice or internal combustion engine.
Yeah, probably not getting back to the V10 days where it's literally screaming at you, but... Yeah. Well, I guess we can kind of get into the actual race here. And right off the rip, it did kind of seem like almost parallel to the 2023 campaign where you get off to a start and the Red Bull in the lead pulls away.
Yeah, and by the same... Verstappen-esque gap, I guess, this race did the same. I mean, 9 laps, 9 seconds. So even back in 2012, we see sort of a dominance with the RB car. That will not end up boding well for them at the end of this particular race.
No. So what was sort of...
all that much more... interesting.
Yeah, what was interesting about this the starting grid was you had the Sebastian Vettel of Red Bull on pole, but then his teammate Mark Webber, the Australian, was back in 17th or 18th, so they were all sorts of spread out. And then, you know, there were some other drivers who, knowing what we know now, were, you know, kind of, I guess, really aggressive going for the win. Of course, you had Fernando Alonso, Lewis Hamilton, Kimi Raikkonen, Nico Rosberg, a young Nico Hulkenberg, Jenson Button, and then Michael Schumacher in his last season with Mercedes before he retired.
Yeah, not to spoil the end of this, but ended up a podium finisher in this race.
Yeah, so...
several things that happened late.
Yeah, this one was... this one, like what happens a lot in F1 is, you know, you get the beginning, which is always pretty crazy and hectic, and then sort of settles into a groove, and then a couple inciting incidents happen and all of this chaos sort of transpires down the pipe, if you will. So I don't know, I guess what were some of your highlights here?
The first thing I noticed is the amount of debris when there was contact left on the course.
Yeah, and I don't, yeah.
Now we see contact, and if there's just a slight shaving of anything, we get yellow, you know, either a yellow with the full course caution or a safety car. In this particular race, there was a lot of contact and debris was left on the track just, you know, for everyone to kind of drive around. I didn't see a whole lot of yellow cleaning up. It was just left out there. And I thought, well, that's weird. Now, if we see contact and we have any kind of debris on the racetrack, there's definitely a different following now, or a different, you know, we might see a virtual safety car or a safety car until somebody can duck out. The other thing that I noticed was the marshals were not really as in tune with getting cars off the course. So there was a couple of instances in this race where, you know, there was six guys hovered around a car on the track and people still coming in at speed. So
yeah,
definitely a different look now, safety wise.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big takeaways. And I guess I didn't really think that some of the safety measures that are taken now have really only transpired in significantly more recent times, because, you know, this isn't you know, a decades old race, you know, it's not even 12 years ago, but the way the series functioned in terms of just some of the, I guess, logistics of the race is significantly different, like you said. So definitely interesting.
Yeah. And the other thing I realized is we've come so far with telemetry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love the left-facing tower that we have now versus the scrolling on the bottom of the screen. Sounds lame. Listen, guys, if you're not race fans and you don't watch a lot of this stuff, this won't make any sense to you. But being able to track positions and time attack and you know, what car is ahead of what car time wise, we've come a long way.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the maybe the little things that you kind of take for granted now with modern broadcasting and graphics, but in 2024, when there's a race going on, you know what every car position they're in, you know the gap between the car ahead of them, and you know exactly what tire they're running all the time. You know that the whole time.
Yeah, and that's really a great, it's a really a great look. The difference, even just, you know, like you said, 2012 versus 2024, as a spectator on TV. And, you know, now we have the great option of, you know, spending a pittance of $80 a year to be able to have the app, which now you can key into whatever car or driver you want to key into. And I can have a tablet in front of me in conjunction with what's on TV, and I can listen to whatever radio calls I care to. So that's a great, you know, that's so much better. It's so much more engaging to be able to watch a race that way.
Yeah, most definitely. The modern broadcast is, you kind of wonder where it even goes from here, but yeah, I'm sure they'll figure some more cool stuff to show during broadcasts. I guess, you know, getting back into the race, like we said, we sort of had Seb Vettel pulling away, and there was some good battles over the track. So honestly, I think the big story, and, you know, towards the end, of course, but Fernando Alonso starts in 11th in this particular race, and he spends pretty much all of the race just moving up the field. So that was really cool to see, because there were constant battles with him and some really ballsy moves from a lot of these drivers that honestly I don't really know if you would see today. I just think in modern F1 drivers are just drilled to, you got to be clean all the time. If there's a move you don't think you can make 100%, don't do it. You know, it's just it's a different style of racing nowadays.
Yeah, we had a safety car on lap 28. Hamilton has a really bad pit stop. It was 14 plus seconds. And also between 2009 and 2012, I don't know what exact year it was between those three, but now we're seeing no fuel. They were not fueling cars in 2012.
Yeah.
But to have a 14-second stop is not good. Alonso up to second place on the restart after that lap 28 safety car. And then Vettel had some kind of a failure around lap 35. Grosjean out lap 41. And then basically it's Hamilton and Maldonado who collide and give us our finish of one, Alonso in the Ferrari, two, Kimi Raikkonen, and then third place to Michael Schumacher.
Yeah, that was a cool moment to see, obviously, you know, a legend of the sport and obviously over the hill by that point in his career, but cool to see him get on the podium. I loved the, because this was an era where Hamilton was not dominating. And when he collides, or I guess Maldonado sort of collides into him, the visible frustration that he showed was immense, because you could see he was bashing the steering wheel, and then he takes it off, throws it out of the car, and
I've never seen a driver throw a $30,000 steering wheel
yeah
into the wall as he did.
Well, obviously that is, yeah, a big deal, but I mean in modern day Lewis Hamilton, I mean, to see him even a little bit upset is sort of rare, especially like physically speaking, like body language and stuff. That's not really something you really see from him. So,
yeah. No, I think these guys, they get more mature and they age, and the passion that you may have had when you were in your early 20s is much different than the way you look at a race in your early 30s or mid 30s,
mm-hmm.
which is really interesting to watch. So I'm really glad that we decided to go back in time and watch some of the races in the past. And we'll probably do a few more before this season kicks off here. Which will be pretty shortly, actually. You know, we're looking at maybe a month before
yeah.
we get into this next year. So if you're a fan of F1 and you're listening to this podcast, I would, you know, implore you to spend the money for the app.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not a big ask. And it really gives you a chance to go back to some of these races. And I think before we end our historical race recap, maybe we should go back to 80s or 70s or, you know, something like that. And
yeah,
I'm really interested to see the year that Andretti made his kind of climb, you know, so
yeah,
that would be a good season to focus on.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely, if anything, it just gives you more kind of context and perspective on how F1 functions and how it got to the point where it's at now. You know, it's kind of something you should probably do if you're, you know, getting into the series. Yeah, so Alonso takes this one. It ended up being a home race victory for him as a Spaniard. And like you said, Michael Schumacher on podium. Interestingly, just one last little thing here. Some guys we're still familiar with, obviously Fernando Alonso and Lewis Hamilton. A Sergio Perez in his second season, driving for Sauber. Interestingly, also I think it was Sauber had the Chelsea Football Club badge on their car.
I did.
Yeah, I don't know what that was about necessarily.
No. Stickers mean dollars.
Yeah. So I kind of am interested, maybe after the show, do a little research on what that was all about.
Yeah. You brought up the fact that this was a very emotional win for Alonso.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you can bring home the number one spot in your home country. And that was pretty, you could tell, I try to watch the post the best I can. And he was, emotional, which he should have been, you know, that's a big deal. And it go ahead.
No, I don't think I was right, but I think 2012 was the last time he's won a race in F1. Could be wrong, but
possible.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just thinking out loud, but yeah. So there were definitely some good moments in here for sure, and a lot of very storied drivers of the series, past and present. You know, Jenson Button in there, Daniel Ricciardo. Heikki Kovalainen. I mean, these are all big, Felipe Massa. These are all big names. And just some ones that are maybe more interesting to us, like Grosjean, of course, Haas, and now IndyCar fame.
Mark Webber, Hulkenberg, Nico Rosberg, Paul de Resta.
Yeah, he does some commentary.
Button, Sergio Perez, Bruno Senna in the Williams Renault car.
Yeah.
I'll just go down. Some of these guys are long gone. Petrov in the Caterham Renault, which Caterham is a English car builder, famous for the Caterham 7. Which is kind of a fendered four-wheel F1 car for the street. Just really cool to go back and look through some of these names that you don't. Felipe Massa.
Yeah, huge, you know, obviously.
Yeah, that's pretty huge. And just seeing the constructors, Cosworth. Renault, which you don't see too much around anymore. And it was funny that McLaren was a McLaren Mercedes.
Yeah, that was McLaren in the name. If I'm not mistaken, McLaren still runs a Mercedes power unit. It's just not McLaren Mercedes. They're just McLaren, but with a Mercedes power unit.
Yep.
So yeah, and this was still an era where McLaren were not fighting, well, not world championship caliber, but they were still a team that you needed to be on the lookout for. And that was the last season that Lewis Hamilton raced for McLaren, 2012. So a lot changed shortly after.
Pretty handsome cars.
Mm-hmm.
Looked a little insect-like with the way the nose kind of falls over.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just a small wing on the rear, much smaller than the wings we see today. So
yeah, the trend has just been that the car gets bigger all the time, but
yeah, bigger, longer, faster
makes Monaco less and less watchable each year, but I digress. All right, well, I think that pretty much does it here on the F1 side of things. Might have went a little long, but so be it. A lot of good news coming out of the paddock, so and never a bad thing to go back in time and do our due diligence with some history. But let's go ahead and shift gears into the world of soccer. And again, with the Premier League, it was sort of a split card, like I said last week. So this match week spanned two weekends, so you didn't have your usual slate of games, so the picks were a little thin, I won't lie. But we're going to be covering the Arsenal match here, which ended up being pretty noteworthy, I'd say. But once again, I just want to quickly touch on the table and keep everyone knowing where we are in the title race, as it is still pretty hot. So Liverpool remain top after they had a pretty convincing win against Bournemouth. 21 matches played now, 48 points. Man City behind them in second with a match less played on 43 points. And then Arsenal leveled on points with Man City after their win against Crystal Palace, which we'll get into, 43 points. Aston Villa, 43 points. Ange Postecoglou's Tottenham Hotspur sitting fifth on 40 points. Down at the bottom, Sheffield United remain one of the more poor sides you'll ever watch in the Premier League. 21 matches played, 10 points. Burnley, 21 matches played, 12 points. Luton Town, it's sort of interesting that the fact that they're even fighting to get out of relegation is a big deal for them. 18th on 16 points with a game less played to Everton, who sit just 1 point ahead of them. So if they win their game in hand, they would actually jump ahead of Everton into Premier League safety. So definitely a lot to keep track of and a lot to keep an eye on. This weekend is an FA Cup weekend, so there's not going to be any Premier League. So I guess we'll have to, I don't know what we're going to do at the moment, but we'll have a Scottish Cup slate or Scottish Premiership slate. So definitely keep an eye on that.
Yeah, so give me the top three again on the table for the Premier League.
So Liverpool, Liverpool first, 48 points. Man City second, 43. Arsenal third, 43.
Okay.
So with this one, it was guns a-blazing for Arsenal. It was really nice to see some sort of real attacking fervor from Arsenal. And I think some people would be a little remiss to kind of count this team out from the title race, as they flexed their attacking muscles in this one.
Yeah, so Arsenal pretty quick out of the gate, and I don't have my typical time signatures in my notes, but corner kick pretty quickly into this match, Gabriel goal, and it was a nice header. So 1-0 Arsenal fairly early, if I remember correctly.
11th minute, and a little bit of controversy surrounding this one. I think it was actually kind of valid. Some people saying he basically jumped on the back of Chris Richards, American defender for Crystal Palace. A game to forget, but so be it. He basically jumped on the back of Chris Richards to score this goal, which would be impeding the defender. But I don't know. Didn't get called, 1-0 anyways. And we were off and running in this one. And it ended up being a pretty shocking day for Crystal Palace as a whole, who are a team that they are just constantly, I feel like, constantly underperforming with the roster that they have. So I'm looking at the lineups now, and Eberechi Eze, Jeffrey Schlupp, let's see here, Tyrick Mitchell, Jefferson Lerma. These are all guys that play at a very high level. Michael Olise didn't feature in this one, but he's also very good for Crystal Palace. These are all great attacking players, and Crystal Palace consistently are a team in the division that score like the least amount of goals. So I just can never seem to figure them out, honestly.
You could tell they were on their heels pretty quickly in this match. 37th minute, we have a corner kick. And then a VAR for the Arsenal goal, and ends up being a good score. 2-0 in the 37th. 4 minutes of stoppage takes us to the half. And then pretty much after that, I really would have liked to see a little spark from this Crystal Palace team.
Yeah.
Which I never did.
No.
And, you know, sadly, as a lot of these matches go, second half was mostly me building Legos and looking at other shit.
Yeah. Again, so this one was, you felt like, sort of done and dusted. After the second goal, which came from the corner again, which horrendous defending, which is kind of a theme for Crystal Palace in this one. And then, yeah, so Arsenal make a couple substitutions. Or maybe they don't. I might have just made that up. But anyways, Leandro Trossard, he wasn't a sub. He was just, he came on for this game. After recently not being in the team. That's why I thought he was subbed on. But Leandro Trossard, who has been one of the better signings for Arsenal in recent memory, he scores. He came from Brighton, if I am not mistaken. Yeah, he came from Brighton, and he was damn good there. 121 appearances, 25 goals for the Seagulls. He's, you know, he's been a little on and off with Arsenal, but he's a player that when he turns it on is quite good. So he is pretty much released by David Raya, the Arsenal goalkeeper, with a fantastic downfield throw and shockingly defended once again by Crystal Palace. He Trossard has a great finish at the end too, sort of just playing with the keeper and slots it home to make it 3-0. And by then you pretty much know the result of this one. Crystal Palace.
Is that an own goal?
The
second own goal.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
The second goal was given as an own goal. Henderson, Dean Henderson, Crystal Palace's keeper. With those, sometimes, you know, it's really not the defender's fault.
Right.
It's yeah, unlucky. In again, just to beat a dead horse, but Crystal Palace is defending in this one, not so hot, and I think Dean Henderson was left to dry a little bit on a number of different occasions here.
And is the Crystal Palace manager 105 years old?
Roy Hodgson, yeah. He is the oldest manager in the Premier League. He managed Crystal Palace for maybe 5 or 6 years in the 2010s.
And he's 105, right?
He's like 79, but... yeah, weird. So again, this is one of those things where I just cannot figure out Crystal Palace. So they had Roy Hodgson. They started playing like this, so they canned him after a few seasons. And they hire Patrick Vieira, an Arsenal legend, mind you, who made Crystal Palace significantly more exciting to watch, and they scored more goals. But they were a bit weakier in defense, if you can believe it. And the second things went wrong, they just canned Vieira and brought back Roy Hodgson. So it's like, okay, why did we do that? Because Crystal Palace are just a team that they never are in they're never in actual relegation trouble. But they are never, ever, ever fighting for European places. So they're just stuck in this malaise of being kind of good, but kind of shit every season, like depending on the week. I mean, this team beat or came back from 2 goals down against Man City like a month ago. And then they go to Arsenal and get thrashed, or they lose to like Brentford. So it's a team you cannot figure out, and I honestly wish they were more competitive because they have a great wealth of attacking talent. And then two quick-fire goals at the end of this one from Gabriel Martinelli. Again, by this point, Crystal Palace had pretty much packed it in, but still some well-taken goals, and it ends 5-0 to Arsenal. I don't know. What do you think? Is this Liverpool's to lose at this moment in time? Do you expect something from Man City, who have been, they've been a little rocky, but you know, it's Man City. So
I guess it comes down to what the matches are going to be. So yeah. Do we have anything coming up where one so, versus another?
Yeah, I just looked. February 4th, Arsenal and Liverpool play.
Oh, that'd be a good one.
Yeah, so that's definitely one to... We'll be watching that, let's just say that. I agree. I think if Arsenal are legit contenders, that's a game they have to win at home. So that's at the Emirates. I would expect Liverpool to win that one. And at this moment in time, I would expect Liverpool to win the title. I don't think Man City have really been your classic Man City of years past, where they just can grind out results no matter what. They do actually look vulnerable from time to time. So it's going to be a good title race to the finish once again. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. And looking forward to the full return of the Scottish Premiership this weekend as well. So definitely keep an eye on both of these title races as the weeks go on.
All right. So coming up on 60 minutes of broadcast time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we're, unless you have some other pearls of wisdom, we probably should get going.
I no pearls of wisdom. Jim Harbaugh, Gonzo to the Chargers. So there's that.
Yeah. And I didn't expect anything else.
Yeah. Not surprising.
No. So what I'll say about that is when you crucify someone for actions that are not really in your realm of responsibility, the Big Ten can fuck themselves. You know, you took a really good coach and you gave him the shaft on 2 points. And I do not blame him for leaving. I hope he is a successful NFL coach. I think he's got the chops.
Yeah.
To get it done. I only hope that whoever takes the helm at Michigan can follow well in his footsteps. And, you know, my best hope is that the Michigan football program continues on the charge that they have created and beating Ohio State, and now we're national champions. It's going to be really tough to get back to that championship level team.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I have no qualms about him leaving.
It there's something sort of poetic about someone that was loved before. Obviously as a quarterback at Michigan in the 80s, and then always sort of a Michigan man, coming back after success with the 49ers and saying, you know, I'm going to make this program be what it's supposed to, and that's be at the top of the tree of college football. And he did it. He delivered on his promise. You know, that's all you could ever ask for as a Michigan fan. You know, did it take a little longer than we wanted it to? Yeah, but he got there. Yep. And, you know, he left the program much better than he found it. So that's kind of all you can ever hope for as a fan.
Those who stay will be champions.
That is true. And you know what? In my life, I would read that banner that's in our garage, and I would inwardly sort of just laugh, because I always was like, is that really true? Because the Michigan football I grew up on was fucking terrible. But here we are. The last 3 years have been brilliant. So
yep.
We're back, I suppose.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, continue to be back. All right. So,
if you have nothing else,
that's going to be it for me.
Yes. Dad'll be happy. We're at 103, so that's 60 plus minutes of time for you. And we will get gone.
Sounds good.
Right at your baby, but here's my number, so call me maybe. Hey,
4
this is crazy.
Executive producers Richard Tanaka, Jim Griggy, Chris Albert, and Godspeed to the coach. We'll see you next time. This is Tackling the Chicane, copyright 2024.